My name is Richard Fremmel. I'm 75 years old at this time. I was born in Chicago, Illinois, and enlisted in the Air Force in 1958. I retired in October 31st of 1981. I served in Vietnam from 69 to 70. I was a aircraft engine mechanic. I repaired engines on piston engines on different aircraft that were over there that served in the war.
Just take a moment and think back to who you were before the war and who you were after the war. How were those two different? Those two men?
I don't know if there was any difference. Maybe my wife might have noticed the difference. I don't know. But I re-enlisted over there after 12 years of service. And so for about 11 and a half years, I was beforehand, and I did my job. That's what I was supposed to do. I learned my job, and to me, I was practicing to go to war. And when I went to Vietnam, I was actually doing the job I had practiced at. You know, we had a job to do, and we did it. And that's the way I looked at it. And I also look at it that I'd rather be over there fighting than here in the States fighting. And so I had no problem with going over there to fight the war. Now, I didn't fire any weapons. I didn't shoot anybody. I had a few rockets shot at the base I was on, but I was never really too close contact with the war.
Okay. You mentioned you had an enemy fire. Who was that from?
That was from the VC, and they would shoot rockets in on us. And you never knew. When I was at Pleiku, on each odd number day of the month, we would get one, two, or three rockets launched onto our base. And then we'd have to go into the bunker. They would launch one rocket, we'd go into bunker. 25 minutes later, they'd launch a second one because they knew that after 30 minutes without a rocket come in, they'd release us from the bunker. So they would wait 25 minutes to shoot another rocket in. Sometimes they'd wait 25 more and shoot a third one in. But it was all just to get at us mentally. They had no way of aiming their rockets like they have today.
Okay, let's see. Can you go into a little bit about...
What was that like to have the rockets come into your bunker and to have them... tell us how it smelled.
The rockets never got close to me. It's just somewhere on the base you hear this large explosion, and wherever you're at, you could feel the thud, and you would just immediately go for the bunker. But the closest ever one came was I was in my shop one night, and the rocket landed probably maybe 100 yards from the shop, and as we were running through the shop to go to the bunker, we heard a tinkle on the roof. And the tinkle on the roof was the shrapnel from the rocket landing on the roof. And afterwards, we all went out there and we picked up a piece of the rocket as a souvenir.
Did that ever get to you mentally, the repeated?
I don't know that it did. I really don't. I had just, you do a job, that's all there is.
And you mentioned one of the bases you were staying at, there was one attack that killed 6 to 7 people.
There was...
Could you talk about that? Yeah.
At Da Nang, there was a rocket that hit we call them hooches, but the barracks right next door to me. And it killed 6 or 7 of the Air Force guys that stayed there. One guy, he was laying on the top bunk, and a piece of shrapnel went right through his bunk and right past his back and didn't hit him because he was laying on his side. And they did send him home right away. I guess it pretty well scared him. I know it scared me. But I wasn't there at the time that the rocket hit. I was there for a few weeks on temporary duty. I went back to Pleiku. I was at Pleiku a week, and I came back, and during that week, the rocket hit the barracks right next to where I was staying.
So you just heard about it?
I just heard about it. I wasn't there when it hit, And I'm thankful for that. Because it would have, that probably might have scared me then. But it, you know, and that's just like a month before I first got to Da Nang, a rocket hit the ammo dump and blew up the ammo dump. And I saw all kinds of pictures of the guys had taken of that. And that was pretty devastating. Not many people got hurt over on that. But we lost a lot of ammunition, a lot of bombs.
So when you heard about these type of things, how did it make you feel? And did it make you change your behavior at all?
Not that I noticed. I really don't think it changed me any. I really don't believe so.
Can you talk a little bit about the basic training leading up to the war before you deployed?
Well, my basic training was 11 weeks at Lackland, but, you know, I thought that was fun. Of course, you got to realize Air Force basic training and Army and Marine basic training are totally different. Ours is nowhere near as strenuous as theirs. And we weren't training to be fighters. We were training to be behind the lines, fixing aircraft, so that they could go into war. Whereas in the Army and Marines, those guys are trained to go into war and do the fighting. Before I went to Vietnam, though, I had to go to a base out in California for 3 days and shoot up a lot of ammunition so I knew how to use the weapons. And I thought that was fun. You know, shooting a lot of ammunition, throwing hand grenades and rocket-propelled grenades or rifle-propelled grenades, not rocket-propelled, rifle-propelled. I had fun with that. That was enjoyable.
What was your mindset like going into the war?
You know, at that time I had a wife and two children. And I didn't really like leaving my wife and two children back home, but they were only lived a mile from her mother. And so I felt comfortable leaving them. I knew that my in-laws would take care of my wife and children. And you know, I had a little girl that was 5 months old, another little girl that was 2 and a half. And, well, she was just about turned 3 then. And you know, I just didn't really like going, leaving them, but it was just a job I had to do because that was part of the job of being in the Air Force. When you're in the military, you do as you're told.
Were there any specific times where that separation got to you to where, like, you realize it more, and how did that make you feel?
I don't know if it, anything, you know, there was times I didn't really like being away from my family, but that's a normal. But I knew where I was, I had to be, and I thought that it was someplace that I should be. The people over there, they needed help, and I think they still need help. And I had no problem with being over there and trying to do, you know, help them keep away from communism. And I was a firm believer that communism was bad. And so I had no problem with going over there and trying to help them. But if we're going to fight communism, let's fight it there and not here. Then I didn't have to worry about my wife and children. See, if they were fighting here, I would have to worry about them.
Okay, can we talk a little bit about what specifically your mission or your job was in Vietnam?
Okay. My job was to...
And where it was.
Well, in both bases I was at, my job was to repair aircraft engines. And I worked on C-123s, A-1Es, C-119s, oh boy, O-1s, O-2s, a bunch of different propeller-driven aircraft. Most of them were on the C-123. One unit were what we call the ranch hands. They sprayed the Agent Orange. That was the unit that went out with the spray bars and sprayed Agent Orange on the foliage to kill the foliage. And working on those, you walk underneath there, the spray bars were, when they come back from mission, were always dripping a little bit, and, you know, it was nothing to have a drop on you. And we thought nothing of it. The other 123 outfit, they supplied the Army out there at their forward bases. They would have a perforated steel plate runway, and They would fly in with the cargo, offload it. They'd never shut down the engines. They'd just pull up to the ramp, offload the cargo, accelerate the engines, and all the stuff would just roll off the back of the aircraft. And then they would leave. If there was anytime one of these airplanes broke, they would call the engine shop and they would want an engine mechanic. So that would be when I would go out to that flying unit and I would work on the aircraft in their particular area, the base. The 123 outfit that did the supplies, sometimes their aircraft broke at a forward operating base. And then I would have to fly out there and repair it and then fly back home on it. But they would never let me spend the night out at those bases. I had to leave and go back to Da Nang.
Okay. I'm sorry, I want to throw something out here. Will, you may be getting ready to ask the same follow-up, but I love it's so interesting to me, Rich, that y'all had a name for those planes. And could you just say again what you called those planes and what their missions were? And where did that name come from?
Well, probably the ones you're talking about were probably Puff the Magic Dragon and Spooky and...
No. About, you mentioned...
The Ranch Hands?
Yeah. Could you just go over that one more time?
I have no idea where the name came from. When I got there, they were called the Ranch Hand Outfit, and that was all I knew. The rest, they were just garbage haulers. We called them garbage haulers, but what they hauled was not garbage. They were just resupply aircraft.
What exactly was it that they hauled?
Anything. Food, ammunition, whatever they needed out there. So the 123s hauled a lot of cargo. Just whatever those guys needed. A lot of food, because it takes a lot of food to feed those guys. And a lot of ammunition.
So back to the Ranch Hands and the Agent Orange. Anyone at that time tell you, or did anyone know about the effects of it?
Not that I know of. I was never briefed on it. I didn't know about it till long after the Vietnam was over with. Agent Orange is, we didn't know that it was bad and it would hurt me. We had no idea. Nobody told us that Agent Orange was bad for us, that it would cause us physical damage. We never knew it. It was just something that defoliated the forest. And we didn't know until long after it was over with that, hey, Agent Orange was bad for us.
Okay. Did you ever see any effects of the Agent Orange on Vietnamese citizens?
No, I never saw the effects of it on any Vietnamese, no. I didn't know anything about that. I've heard that some of our GIs had some problems with Agent Orange. And they say that my heart problem is result of Agent Orange. But that's all.
What heart problem?
I have what they call systemic heart disease. And they said that is a direct correlation to Agent Orange.
How does that affect your life now?
I don't let it affect my life right now. It did until I had surgery. Now I just don't think about it.
Did the government help you with your heart disease in any way?
They're giving me a VA disability, which means I get paid each month because of the disability. And I also can use the VA for medical care, but having Medicare and the military, I don't need to use the VA except when I have to. And they require me to come over twice a year.
Can you talk about what you did with the empty containers of Agent Orange?
I don't know if I want to say that on camera, but the containers we use the containers, the empty containers as a bathroom. Okay, is that what you're getting at?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought that was what you were getting at. Yeah, we use the Agent Orange container, the empty containers, as a bathroom. Rather than go to a latrine that might be, several hundred yards away, the empty containers are about 50 feet away, so when you got to go, you got to go. They didn't like us using the landing gear, so it was, we used empty containers.
Okay. Did any of the aircraft that you worked on, were any of those aircraft used to drop napalm?
No. Well, they might have, the A1s might have been. I don't know if they dropped napalm or not. I really don't know what was on the A1s. I know they had a lot of different things, bombs on their wings when they went out. They had four 20-millimeter cannon. They had the little CBUs, the little tiny cluster bombs. But if there was napalm on there, I really don't know.
You mentioned the cluster bombs. And I'm curious if you're, if I'm not mistaken, those have been banned now by, like, I don't know, treaty, I think. They're banned by, under a worldwide treaties, maybe through the UN or something. And I'm just curious if back then, you had any different view of any of those weapons than you have now, or if your views are, I'm not saying you should or shouldn't, I'm just interested in and if your you know, your thoughts on them have changed over the years or not.
No, my thoughts haven't changed. If someone's shooting at me, I'd use whatever means I have to shoot back, whether it be a bomb, a rifle, or a gun of any sort. I'm going to defend myself. And that's what these pilots were doing. They were defending either their lives or the lives of our military on the ground.
Thank you.
Okay. What was your favorite type of engine to work on? And did that desire ever change?
I liked working on all engines, in all honesty. I loved being a mechanic. I loved working on aircraft engines, and that's why I stayed in the Air Force to begin with. Now, like I said, I reenlisted at 12 years over to Vietnam. When I first went reenlisted the first time in 1962, I did it because I liked what I was doing. I felt a sense of accomplishment every time I worked on an engine and it ran good. And I had that sense of accomplishment, that immediate gratification that I did a good job. And I just liked doing it. I really enjoyed being a mechanic. And I you know, if nowadays, I can't even fix my own car because you can't have you got to have so much expensive equipment. Besides the fact I'm getting too old.
Okay. Speaking about the pilots, we spoke about the relationship between the mechanics and the pilots. Can you talk about that and what type of responsibility you felt?
Well, the pilots, you know, when you get on an aircraft, the pilot has your life in his hands or her hands. They're the ones that, you know, they don't do their job right.
I'm sorry, you're saying the mechanic has the life.
No, when you get on an aircraft, the pilot has your life. When you're flying, he's the guy that's got your life in his hands. But, you know, he also realized that before he ever climbed in that aircraft, I worked on that aircraft. I fixed those engines. And if I didn't do my job right, I had his life in my hands. So it was both ways. We both realized that, you know, either the mechanic or the pilot, we had the other person's life in our hands at some time or another during a mission.
Did that responsibility make you change your behavior in any way?
I treated the pilots like I always did. You know, treated them right, and they treated me right. That's just the way you do. You treat each other with respect. For, you know, you respect them for what their abilities are. I had to respect an officer for being an officer, but I respected him for his abilities more than the fact that he was an officer.
Can you talk about how you gained your reputation as a mechanic?
Well, just one incident when I was over in Vietnam. I had to go out to a forward base because an aircraft engine had failed. And the pilot happened to be the squadron commander of the flying unit, Lieutenant Colonel. And he told me what the problems were, what the indications were, and I said, sir, there's 3 gallons of oil up in the nose of that engine. Now, this engine's not supposed to have any oil inside, just a light film on all the working parts. The oil is kept in a big tank, a 30-gallon tank behind the engine. So he said, nah, can't be. He knew there wasn't supposed to be oil up there. I said, I bet there is. So I got a garbage can and I pulled this pump off the bottom of the nose section of the engine, and about 2 or 3 gallons of oil came out of it. And he says, let me see that pump. So I showed him the pump, and he took the pump and he spun the gear and he saw the pump working. And he says, there's nothing wrong with this pump. I said, that's right, sir, but look up in that hole. And he looked up in the hole and he says, I don't see nothing wrong up there. And I took a long screwdriver and I pointed up in the hole and I said, you see that shaft right there? He says, yeah. I said, there's supposed to be a gear to drive this pump. And you could just see the light come on. He realized, hey, that pump wasn't working. And that pump was supposed to pump any oil out of that nose section back to the oil tank. And from that time on, anytime there was a flying unit, that flying unit had an aircraft down, they came over and picked me up and took me over to their aircraft and flew me to the aircraft to fix it. And I had a good reputation then. And I enjoyed that reputation. I thought it was real good.
That must have been a hell of a nice feeling. Can you talk about how that felt?
Oh, it felt great. I mean, anything I wanted, I could get. And, you know, we would have a little, the engine shop would have a little party. Now, I was a reciprocating engine shop that was a section of the jet engine shop, which was a massive shop, had probably at least 100 mechanics assigned. And we would have a party every once in a while. So I'd let it be known that I could sure use a case of steaks and a case of chicken. And within a day or so, I would get a phone call. Hey, Sergeant Fremmel, there's two boxes over here with your name on it. It seemed they fell off of a pallet. And I'd go over there, and here's a case of steak and a case of chicken. And we would go and have a party. So, you know, that was just part of the benefits of getting to know the people in the flying unit and having a reputation with them.
While you're on the base, how often did you get to leave, and where would you go if you did?
In Vietnam, we worked 6 days. We were scheduled to work 6 days a week. There was a lot of weeks that was seven. But we were scheduled to work 6 days a week. And on that day off, we could take a bus over to China Beach, which was a little Navy place. I don't know if it was Cameron Bay, some bay there by Da Nang. And we would take a bus through there, and you'd drive through the city, and you'd see the poverty. That's what really got to me, was all the poverty that I saw, the way people had to live over there. I don't think I could have lived like they did. It really bothered me. That bothered me, because I don't like seeing that kind of poverty.
Do you think that reinforced your feelings about the war while you were there?
It probably reinforced me wanting to do my job the best I could and not be afraid or ashamed for being there, because I was never ashamed of what I did over there. I still am not. It's just the people, the way they were living, and the shacks that they were living in, the clothes that they wore. It just was, you could tell that they didn't have anything. The houses were just shacks. They weren't real houses. And the clothes, they were sort of tattered and not looking good. Of course, they all had their black pajamas and their hats on that you probably saw pictures of. The ones that worked on base, they seemed very nice. They treated us right. And we had what we called mama-sans. The mama-san would do our laundry for us, so I never had to do laundry. They washed my uniforms. They pressed my uniforms. And I never had to worry about that. Didn't have to make my bed, because they would make my bed for me.
Who were the mama-sans?
They were the locals, women from the local area. They were the women, they were local women that worked on the base, and there would be two or three assigned to a barracks that would do all of our laundry, clean our area, make our beds, change the beds once a week. They were just, you know, housewomen. The mama-sans were the local women that worked on the base. There were two or three assigned to each barracks. And there might have been more than that. I don't know. I knew I had at least two in the local area that I was, in the floor I was on. And they would do all of our laundry. They would iron our clothes. They would clean our area. They would make our beds, change our beds. You know, basically take care of us. And most of us treat them right. We would pay, I don't remember how much we paid, but I know all of us would kick in a few extra dollars, a tip for the mama signs. I think we probably didn't pay more than $2 or $3 a week for them. And we would all kick in, give mama signs a couple extra bucks now and then. And I kept Cokes in my refrigerator because I had a refrigerator over there, one of those little small apartment size. And Mama-san liked Coke, so I would always tell her that she could have one Coke a day. And my room was, my area was always nice and clean, and there was always one Coke a day taken from my refrigerator, but that was okay by me.
Again, I'm just going to, I don't mean to step on your toes here, Will, but this is so fascinating. You said most everyone treated them well. Did you see any incidents, not so much like something you heard about, but I mean, was there any firsthand experience with people not treating?
I have not, did not see any that didn't treat the mama-sans right. You know, in the way they talked with them and that. Some of the guys, yes, there were one or two that sort of thought the mama-sans were beneath them. But most of us, we all treated them right, and we would kick in a few extra dollars a week because they did such a good job for us.
How could you tell when someone thought that the mama-sans were beneath them?
Just the way they talked about them. They didn't talk about them very nicely sometimes.
Example, please?
I can't really think of a good example that would... You got to realize that was quite a few years ago.
Sorry. We've heard Ward described as most basic as simple human survival, kill or be killed. Well, how was your experience with the war? Was that similar? Or?
I don't see it. I'd never had to fire a weapon in anger. You know, I just fixed airplanes. That was all. I had a weapon in my hand twice in a year. And that was just because it was a practice, and we had to go on the perimeter to guard the perimeter in case we were being overrun. But that was just a practice. That was strictly a practice. They gave us our M16, a bandolier of ammunition, and they told us we couldn't load the weapon, period. And when we went on the line, we couldn't load the weapon until we were told, and we couldn't shoot until somebody on our side of the line got hit, which seems sort of stupid to me, but that was the way it was. But the Air Force, you got to realize, the Air Force enlisted are not fighting people.
Okay. Let's do like a word association. If I say war, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? Just start with war is. And...
War is terrible. You want me to expand on that? Is that what you're trying for? You know, I don't like war. I'll tell you right up front, I don't like war. But war is going to happen. People disagree all the time, and people want to take things by force. And somebody has to go in there and stop that. And that's what causes a war. And war is not good. I don't like it. Too many people get killed. Innocent people get killed. And I don't think that's right. But if it has to be, it has to be. You know, when you're firing a weapon, when you're dropping bombs, back in 40, 50 years ago, you had no idea if you're going to kill civilians. Nowadays, they can do a little bit better with aiming their weapons and not getting, reducing the number of civilian casualties. But war is inevitable, and we're always going to have a war someplace. There might be some area times of peace, but there's going to be a war someplace in this world.
Brothers in the army. I mean, that's something it's a moral dilemma, I think, right?
It is a moral dilemma. I don't know how you would reconcile it. You know, you have to realize when you join the military, you've joined that you are going to give an oath that you are going to follow the orders that are given you. You're going to defend the Constitution. You're going to defend this country. And that's what we do. And that's what all the GIs do. Anyone that raises their hand, they're out there and they're willing to give their life if they have to defend this country, to fight for that Constitution, to fight for that flag, to fight for their families back home.
Was there any time during, while you were at Vietnam, where you started to question that?
No time. I never questioned whether I should be there or not. If anything, when I saw the way the people were living over there, I thought that maybe we really needed to be there. The only thing I disliked was our Congress restricting what we could do. Instead of letting the military take care of the situation, the civilians who had no knowledge what was going on, they were dictating what we could do, what we couldn't do.
If you had your choice, how would you have done it?
Sir, I really don't know, because I didn't know all of the things that the powers that be would know.
Well, how was Congress restricting you, and how would you have changed that?
Well, you couldn't go up into North Vietnam. We weren't supposed to go up there. There's so many things that they wouldn't allow us to do. And you know that any time you fight a war, if you're fighting with rules and your opponent does not have the same rules, is that fair? Not fair at all. You know, a lot of our guys got killed because they weren't allowed to do something that they should have done. Don't ask me for specific instances, just things that I remember. I remember this hearing these things that were going on. And that's what I thought, that the rules were getting too stringent and they weren't allowing our military to do the job they were supposed to do.
How do you feel about the way the war ended?
Don't like it at all. We lost. That's the way I feel about it. We lost that war. We didn't win a thing.
Do you think there was any good that came from American side? There was any good that came from it?
I don't know of any. We got experience, that's about all.
I'm sorry, I just want to rephrase that question just so we get it both together, because they're great questions. How did you feel about the way, what were the two questions? Well, how did you feel about the way the war ended, and?
Was there any good that came, as far as the American experience, is there any good that came from it?
How did you feel about the way the war ended, and do you feel there was anything good that came of it?
I didn't like the way the war ended at all, because I felt we lost the war. About anything good coming out of it, the only thing good was the powers that be, the generals and, you know, all the high-ranking officers got experience in war. And experience is what leads them to do better the next time they come into a situation like that. Our pilots got experience fighting a war. Our military got experience fighting a war. You know, I got experience as a mechanic working under wartime conditions. But, you know, that's the only thing that came good that came out of it. Otherwise, good for the people of Vietnam, I don't know of any that came out of it, except some Vietnamese got out of there.
I've seen images when the war ended of people dumping over like helicopters in the ocean and stuff like that. Where were you when the war ended, and do you remember how you felt about it?
I don't know. I was back in the States for sure. And I think when it ended, I was at just north of here at Chanute Air Force Base. Because it ended 72 or 73, something like that. And, you know, just what I read in the newspapers is all I knew. I didn't know anything else. What I read in the papers, what I saw on television.
How did you feel about the way it was covered through the media?
Through the media, all through Vietnam, everything was negative. They didn't show nothing positive. They didn't show where we were helping people. Same with Iraq and Iran and Afghanistan. You see very little about what our GIs are doing over there helping the local people. You see all the negative stuff. The news media just puts out sensationalized negative information, things that are not positive. And I think we need to put out more positive information about how good our people are doing for the people that are in that countries.
Could you give some examples of the kind of thing you're talking about there from Vietnam, what they should, what you would like to have seen covered?
I wasn't involved in any of the good things that might have been happening over there. But I just know from what I've heard of guys that were over in Iraq and Afghanistan, where they were rebuilding schools and helping the people and bringing stuff to the people. You know, we're getting a little more positive over there than we did over in Vietnam. But you see so little of it. How often do you see our GIs over there rebuilding a school? How often do you see them giving out toys to the kids?
You said you weren't a part of the good.
I was not part of that, no.
What was the good things going on?
I don't know what they were doing because I wasn't involved. I was on the base working, and we didn't have any of that going on that I know of.
But you're confident there was good things?
I'm confident there was good things that our GIs were doing. You don't put those GIs out there in the field without them doing some good someplace. The Americans just aren't like that, that we're going to help people if we can. I think that's part of our national heritage. You know, we help others.
Previously you said before or after Vietnam, you're not ashamed of what you did. So why did you feel like you needed to say that?
Probably because of the way the people felt, the Americans people felt during Vietnam. They thought everything was bad. We shouldn't be there. We shouldn't be doing it. We were wrong. Everything negative. And I never felt that way. I was never ashamed.
Did you know people in the service who were?
None that I know of. I really didn't.
And during our pre-interview, you kind of talked about how the protocol of your uniform when you came back.
Yes.
How were you received when you came back from Vietnam?
When I came back from Vietnam, by regulation, I had to fly in uniform. And we came back into Riverside, California. And I had to get to LAX to fly back home to my family. But I was not allowed to leave the airport until I had changed into civilian clothes. And there were three of us. There was a major, myself, and another soldier. We all had to change clothes, and we thought it was terrible that we had to do that to protect ourselves because the way people felt about us. I never had anything negative done to me, but then I never walked around in my uniform either. Not when I came back from Vietnam. And around military bases, I never had any problems.
When I left the
airport, I had no choice. The Air Force told me I had to have civilian clothes to leave the airport. So therefore, you know, as all good military people, you salute smartly and do as you're told.
Doing that, how did that make you feel? You said that you and the other guys were angry.
I was angry about that. I was required to do that. I always used to fly in my uniform. And there were several times when, you know, let's be honest, some guy would buy me a drink or buy me something to eat, you know, because I was in my uniform. But that was before Vietnam. And I did a lot of traveling on commercial airliners, always flew in uniform. Twice I was able to fly first class because I was in uniform. I thought that was rather cool back then. Of course, I was only a 19 or 20-year-old kid, but so what? I thought that was rather cool. But coming back from Vietnam, things weren't that way. We had to, you know, we had to get in civilian clothes. Had no choice.
Do
But I was prepared, and that was all that mattered.
Did you notice, like, for years after Vietnam, a significant shift in the way attitudes were towards veterans?
Around military bases, there I didn't notice anything, really. And I spent, you got to realize, I spent my life around military bases. Ever since I was 18, I've always been somewhere near a military base, either living on it or working on it. And, no, the military has, like, you know, a good reputation because the GIs, they got a guaranteed income, you know, and they're paid okay. And so people think well of them. These are people who are actually working. And I've never had a problem with going to the local communities.
So during our pre-interview, we talked a little bit about your role in rescue missions. So could you talk about your role in pilot rescues, and how did those moments make you feel in comparison to your 12 years of service prior to Vietnam?
Well, there was just the one time over in Vietnam, I had to work on an A-1 aircraft. The A-1 is a propeller-driven aircraft that flies quite slow compared to the F-4s and F-105s that were flying at that time. And when the helicopters would go in to pick up a downed pilot, if there was an F-4 flying over there, they flew too fast to see their target and fire them all on one pass. They'd have to find a target, make a loop around, come back to shoot at the target. Where the A-1 pilot would see his target, would look at him, identify him, and shoot him, if that's what he was supposed to do. And this one time I was working on the A-1 and I didn't get a chance to run the aircraft to make sure the engine was okay. And the pilot asked me, can this airplane fly? I said, I just got to run it, sir. I think it's good. So he says, I'm taking it. And he left. And when he left, he had all his armament underneath his wings. And when he came back, he was empty. All of his armor was gone. He dropped everything. And he says, we got him. He says, the helicopter's coming right behind me with the pilot. Made me feel good. He says, the pilot also said, hey, Sarge, go ahead and sign it off. It's a good engine. So it made me feel good that I had just that little tiny bit to do with getting that pilot back safely.
Could you just say what your little tiny bit was?
Fixing the engine. That was the little tiny bit that I did was fixing the aircraft so that the pilot could go out and do his mission.
So tracking back to when you were talking about going to the beaches and your R&R, did you get a chance to interact with Vietnamese civilians outside of the ones you met in the base?
No. I did not. I did not interact with Vietnamese civilians at any time. That wasn't part of my job. And when I went to China Beach, that was just the name of a place. I guess there was a beach there someplace, but I never was on it.
Where were you?
Huh?
Where were you?
I was in the base exchange at this China Beach, which was a naval station. That was just the name of the naval station.
So what did you get a chance to do while you were there on these Sundays?
On these days off, my day off, I would go over to China Beach and walk around the BX and see what was there. The BX is our base exchange, just to see what was there, if I wanted to buy something, or just to get to ride through the community and look. That's all I did. Most of what I did, shame to say, I did a lot of drinking.
Why are you ashamed to say that?
Because I don't believe in drinking for the sake of drinking. I have no heartburn with having a beer now and then. The fact is, I enjoy a nice cold beer. But when I was over in Vietnam, I drank a lot of beer. Don't ask me why, because I don't know why. Maybe because it was there. I only paid a quarter a can. And you can drink a lot of beer at a quarter a can.
So what did you do to stop your drinking?
Cold turkey. I just quit. 3 or 4 weeks before I came back, I said, this is not the way I want to live. I'm not going back home a drunk. And I quit. I just didn't drink anymore. It's just, if I want to do something, I can do it. That's the same way I quit smoking over there. I wanted to quit smoking, so I quit. Cold turkey, that was the only way to do it.
I want to ask you about R&R. Did you ever have like a leave from the base where you went somewhere else?
No, I didn't. I didn't take any R&R while I was over there. That cost a lot of money, and I was saving my money for when I got back to the States for my family. If I'm not mistaken, I bought a new car when I came back from Vietnam with money that we'd saved. We also had to buy a whole house full of furniture because we didn't have a whole lot.
You're an honorable man. Can you comment on that?
That I'm honorable?
Yeah, you are.
I don't know that I'm honorable. I just try to do the best I can for God, country, and family. That's all I can do.
Did the war give you the opportunity to stop drinking and smoking? I mean, it sounds like you were drinking and smoking before you got in the war, right? But then you quit?
I quit smoking about less than a month after I got to Vietnam. I was only over there probably 2 or 3 weeks when I got fed up with coughing from cigarettes and coughing from the climate change. And I said, that's enough of this. And my wife had always been after me to quit smoking, and I, you know, I'm not going to do as my wife tells me. And so I wasn't going to quit at home. But when I got to Vietnam, I quit. I realized I just needed to quit. And I haven't smoked since. So that was from 1969 to now.
But is there something in particular about that environment that motivated you to quit those things?
No. Not that I know of. You know, I had no problems before that. Smoking was a normal thing back in 1969. Probably, I would say probably 75% of the GIs smoked, if not more. And it was just something that I did. And then I just quit.
So you told us in our pre-interview that you've been to D.C. a few times.
Yes.
And so when you've gone to Vietnam memorials in the past, what emotions did you feel when you were there? Did you notice anything?
It touched my heart. You know, I've been to the moving wall, and I've been to the Vietnam wall a couple of times, and it gave me some emotions because I realized all the guys that died over there. And in a way, sometimes you might say they died for nothing because we gave up. The U.S. gave up on the war. So did we? I don't think we accomplished a mission over there.
Also, when you were there, you told us about the civilian who was sitting.
There was one time when we were there. Now, the wall, it's real tall in the middle, and it goes down. And there's a lady was sitting on one of the low panels, just sitting there on the memorial. And it bothered me. It bothered me enough. I'm not a forward type of person that would go up there and say something. But I had to. And I asked her if she would kindly not sit on the wall. I said, just remember those guys whose names are on that panel that you're sitting on, they died for this country. And she was very apologetic, got up and left.
So you brought in two artifacts.
Yes.
Including a cluster bomb, shrapnel. So I was wondering how you got your hands on.
Well, the piece of shrapnel was from a 122 rocket that hit on the base at Pleiku, and it was, I heard it hit on the roof of our building. And afterwards, we went out, a bunch of us went out there, and we picked up some, couple of pieces to, as a souvenir. And a little piece, the little, I don't know what they call it, but the little piece that was in those bomblets, I don't know where I got it. I don't remember where I got it. I wish I could tell you, but I don't remember where I got it. I just know I got it, and I was told what it was from. It was in my jewelry box, and it's been there ever since I came back from Vietnam. And I just never cleaned it out. I thought sometime maybe somebody might want to see it. It might be interesting for somebody. I also had an AK-47 round that I took out of an engine, but I can't find it. I don't know where it went to.
Can you tell us the story about getting that?
Well, that was on a ranch hand aircraft, one of the Agent Orange spray airplanes. I went up there they had a problem on it, and I went up there and I worked on the problem. We took the aircraft out to run it, and we identified another problem. The one I went to fix was fixed, but another one occurred. So I went up, when I started climbing up to the engine to look at it, try to determine what was causing the problem, I looked up and I see this hole through this conduit. And then I followed a hole through the conduit, and it goes up into the magneto, which fires the spark plugs. And there's a hole into the magneto. So I take the magneto apart, and here's this AK-47 round in the magneto. So we had a whole lot more work we had to do to fix the airplane. He had no idea it was there. None. They didn't write it up. They didn't have any problem. If they would have made the right check, they would have found had the same indications I had, except they wouldn't have known what it was. What it did, it shorted out. Well, this aircraft had 18 cylinders, 36 spark plugs, and it shorted out 9 of the spark plugs. So when I made my check on my ignition system, it showed me that there was something drastically wrong. And that's what made me go looking.
I guess I was just thinking about it in terms of, if they fired at it and it hit the engine, I mean, it could have, how close did it come to killing him or putting the aircraft down?
Well, it could have, you know, it just depends where it hit. Now, these aircraft, they had a bunch of armament around the pilot and co-pilot. The people that ran the spray bars, the spray equipment in the back, they had armament around there. All that armor was around their box that they sat in. And it was all bulletproof. Of course, it was all on the bottom of them, bottom and the sides, because that's where they were going to get hit.
Going to the process of sharing your story with us. Why did you initially decide to share your story with us, and have you, you know, talked to your wife about these same stories or other people?
Well, my wife has already said that she's hearing things she's never heard before. And why? I don't see any reason why not. Might as well share what little bit I can do. There's a lot of things lost. People today have no idea about Vietnam. None whatsoever. They know about Iraq and Afghanistan, but Vietnam was just something that they heard, maybe studied in grade school or high school. But most people just don't even know what went on over there, don't know why we had it, don't know what the GIs went through over there. Most of us, by far, the vast majority, 99% of the guys, I'm sure, had no compulsion about being there. They were glad they were there. They were doing a job that they thought was needed. And we didn't have any problems with the Vietnam. It was the civilians back here in the States.
Well, I'll follow up with that. You said that, Rich, that not, you know, people nowadays don't know about Vietnam. What are just a couple of, or just what is the, what would you like people to know about Vietnam that you feel like they don't know? And how does it make you feel that they don't know about? How does it make you feel that people don't know about Vietnam? And what do you want them to know about that they don't?
I think that the people need to know that, you know, at all the wars that we've been through, no matter where it's at, our military was out there doing the job to the best of their ability without regard for their own lives. They were there to protect our national interest and to protect our country. Because I'm sure they all feel like I do. If we're going to fight, let's fight there and not here. We don't want the fighting on our shores. And that's the reason we fight a lot of these wars. We're trying to fight the aggressors, whoever they might be. And be it the communists that back there in Vietnam, or it could be people like we had over here in Iraq and Afghanistan. And now this ISIS that we're worried about. We don't want those people doing that over here. So let's get rid of them before they get a chance.
Is there anything we've not asked you about that you'd like to share?
I think you've covered a lot. I really do. And I hope somebody gets just one little iota of knowledge out of this. And I will feel that this was all worthwhile.
And, Rich, can I throw out a couple things?
Of course, go right ahead.
Okay, so, and these aren't easy questions, but I'm going to throw them out. We got 3 minutes.
Okay.
So I'll try to make it as quick as possible. We got 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So I got one hard one and one easy one. I forget where I was going.
Yeah, you're not supposed to forget already. You're not 75 yet. Wait till you're 75.
You told me the other day my warranties run out.
Oh.
Okay. Could you just describe? I mean, if someone has never heard of a cluster bomb or this bomblet, what is that? So we're gonna have a photograph of the piece you brought back. But could you just say what that is and how it would operate? And you know, and you're an honorable man, and I don't mean this, and don't take this the wrong way, please. I've traveled, I've seen the scenes that you're talking about of poverty. I've been in 52 countries. You have and I know what you mean when you have a heart for those people. Again, just getting into a moral thing here, is there any moral dilemma with the idea of, you know, these bombs being over there and maybe some of the very people that you had such compassion for, you know, getting accidentally hit or accidentally stepping on one of them or whatever. And again, I'm not pointing, believe me, I'm not pointing your finger, but it's just, I think it's a question that is worth asking. Yeah.
Now, how those cluster bombs work, I couldn't tell you.
Tell Austin, don't look at me.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at Will here.
I mean, no. Well, the redheaded guy.
This guy right here, you're Will, right?
That's Austin?
Yeah. I thought you were Will.
Switch places.
Oh. I can't. I see a face, but I'm not sure. Okay. Austin, I'm sorry. The cluster bombs, I don't know exactly how they're all put together. I didn't do work on bombs. I just know what I was told, that they're little bomblets, that they come out of this container, and they blow up when they get near the ground. That's all I know about them. And they got those little things inside of them. They're mainly anti-personnel. How I feel about being used, when it's being used in combat, somebody shooting at you, I got no heartburn with it at all. If someone's shooting at you, I'm going to do what, You know, you do whatever you got to do to protect yourself. And whatever equipment you've got at your that's available to you, you use it. And that's the way I look at it. You don't just go over there and you bomb a school. I don't believe in that. Not to, unless the school is being used as a for the enemy. And if the kids are in there, you're still probably going to have to be careful what you do.
Okay, and then this was, I appreciate that a lot. So you use this phrase at least once and maybe twice. You salute smartly and follow orders. Is that, I think that's the way you say it. You salute smartly
and do as you're told.
Yeah, salute smartly and do as you're told. Could you talk about where did you pick that way of life or way of living up? I know the answer to it, but I want you to say it. I want you to say the phrase and then say where you acquired that. And then tell me if that influences your life now at all, the way you live your life now.
Well, that's just part of being in the military. You always salute officers, and then when you're told by an officer to do something, you salute smartly and do as you were told, unless it's going to hurt you. That's just the way I've always done things. If my supervisor tells me to do something, I usually do it, unless it's going to hurt me. But if my supervisor tells me to do a job, I do the job. That's just the way I've always lived my life.
Does that apply? How would that phrase maybe apply to anything you're involved in, that you do now or you're involved in the community? Does that phrase relate to your current life at all?
I don't know. Do as you're told is probably the best thing way to say it. In current terms, just do as you're told. Especially by somebody that knows that would be in charge. That's just the way I would do it. And I don't know if it affects my normal life or not.
I'm just thinking about it in terms of being part of a team and almost self-sacrifice. And, you know,
I don't think that term would be used for self-sacrifice. But, you know, when you join the military, you're willing to give your life. And that would be yes. It's just like our police officers, our firefighters. You know, they're willing to put their life on the line for you. The military the same way.
Anything else you want to throw in?
Not that I can think of.
Thank you so much.
I think you tore me up.
You're great.
Okay, thank you.